Welcome to the Donna Sebo Show. Donna is an international mental practitioner, psychic, award-winning author, counselor, speaker, teacher, and radio television talk show personality. She brings to the airwaves talented people from around the world who share their insights and experiences with you, the listening audience. Now, let's join Donna.
Hello and welcome. This is Donna Sebo. Welcome to an hour of mind power. Mind power plus what I would call research power, thinking power. All of this goes into place. And our topic today is one that I know many people have just such a diverse level of opinion on. But we're going to be talking with a man who's done the research inside the real Area 51. Now, you think after all of the information that's been put out about it, that we would say, well, enough is enough. We know it all. However, the entire truth, I don't know it's ever really going to be known as perhaps we would like for it to be known, just because of the patterns of certain environments, whether it's government, other situations. We may not know all of the details, but my guest, Thomas Carey, has just a lot to share here, and I want to welcome him to the airwaves. Welcome to the show, Thomas.
Hi, Donna. Nice to be with you.
Now, you have a master's degree in anthropology. You're an Air Force veteran who was in top security levels, and you have spent over 22 years investigating the Roswell incident. You've written extensively about it. What was it for you as an individual that made you decide that you were going to investigate this? After all, you were in the Air Force. You were in top security. What's the big deal? Why was this so important to you? Why do you still today want to continue to educate and make people aware of facts that most might say, who gives a hoot?
Well, Donna, it's like most people, you have certain interests.
Mm-hmm.
And myself, I've always been interested in the mysterious, in the unexplained, things like that hold your interest. As a kid, I was interested in UFOs, of course, like a lot of us, because we didn't know what they were, and to a large extent, we still don't know. But as a teenager, I read a couple books by Donald Kehoe and a few other books about UFOs, and I thought, well, that's interesting. I wonder what these things are. Our top jet fighters can't catch up to them, and they seem to come and go at their own wish. So after I got out of the Air Force, I picked up my interest again when I read the 1980 book, The Roswell Incident, by William Moore and Charles Berlitz.
Mm-hmm.
The book just blew me away for the simple reason that we were not talking about lights in the sky, things that, go bump in the night, things like that. We were talking about real nuts and bolts, physical craft and bodies. And mm-hmm. that's what really caught my interest, is that we were really talking about something that had crashed, a physical craft with occupants. And after I read that book, I said, boy, this is it for me. And then, 10 years go by and there's nothing more. And until these two fellows, Kevin Randall and Don Schmidt, reopened the case in the late 1980s and published a book, UFO Crash at Roswell in 1991, which really caught the public's fancy. And that's when the case really became a household word, was after the Randall and Schmidt book, UFO Crash at Roswell. Well, by that time, I had a master's degree in anthropology. I had done some years of PhD work at the University of Toronto, and my specialty was physical anthropology and archaeology, and part of the Roswell legend was that the craft and bodies were discovered by a group of archaeologists from the University of Pennsylvania. Well, I was living in Philadelphia at the time. I live right now outside of Philadelphia. And so I called up Kevin Randall. I said, what have you done about these archaeologists trying to find them? He said, well, we had a name or two, but nothing panned out. So we gave up on trying to find them. I said, look, I have a background in this subject, and let me go down to the University of Pennsylvania, which is in Philadelphia, by the way. Let me have a look around and see what I can find out about who was in New Mexico in 1947 and whether they're still alive and if I can locate them. And to make a long story short, I did. I interviewed just about every archaeologist that was in New Mexico in 1947 who was alive in 1991 when I mm-hmm. first started my investigation of this. And so we did find several who, one of whom owned up to it, who said he was there and he saw everything. And most of the others stated that they never heard anything about this. And most of them I believed, some I didn't. I did discover one who was a professor at the University of Pennsylvania, who I'm positive was there, a fellow by the name of John Cotter, who did a lot of work on the Clovis Paleo-Indian site in the 1930s and 40s. And that's how I got involved in the case. And since then, I've gotten into every area of the case. And then, mm-hmm. since 1998, have teamed exclusively with Donald Schmidt to continue the proactive investigation of the case until we can't investigate it anymore.
In the introduction of your book, Inside the Real Area 51, this is about the secret history of Wright-Patterson. But I wanted to bring to my audience's attention a statement that you make right in the introduction, which is so true. I mean, you just listened to the news that was being aired yesterday. The deception, lies, and cover-up that are being, and normally I don't get into this genre on my show, but it is so blatant. We have a situation where we have people that are supposedly making, or it's supposed to be in the capacity of making good decisions, out and out lying. Their credibility is just right in the toilet, as far as I'm concerned, has been for a long time. And deception to the American public is just at an all-time high. And you bring that out in your introduction. And you said this cannot be relegated to an old warehouse and just say this is forgotten history. It's important that we go after the truth. And you have a quote in your introduction from John F. Kennedy. He said, the very word secrecy is repugnant in a free and open society. And we as a people, as Americans, inherently and historically opposed to secret societies, we're opposed to secret oaths and to secret proceedings. And we're opposed by others that have a monolithic and a ruthless conspiracy that relies primarily on covert means for expanding its sphere of influence, on infiltration instead of invasion, on subversion instead of elections, on intimidation instead of free choice. And there's more to the quote than that. And I thought, this is a very powerful statement. And we've gone through things like this in our history in the United States. We've had ups and downs, we've got our warts, we've got all kinds of things in the history of the United States. This situation with Roswell involved blatant out-and-out lying by the United States government. And I always like to tell people, a government is no more than the people that run it. And it was hidden for fear. It was also hidden for, I think, the purpose of utilizing technology that nobody had any knowledge about, saying, we want it, we don't want anybody else to have it. But let's go in to Wright-Patterson Air Force Base. This has a lot of history to it. Tell us some of the history of Wright-Patterson.
Well, Donna, first of all, I agree with everything you just said. I couldn't have said it better. As far as Wright-Patterson is concerned, it was started out as an airstrip founded by the Wright brothers, Orville and Wilbur Wright, in the early 1900s to develop their newfangled flying machine that they had conquered. They made the first heavier-than-air flight, Kitty Hawk, North Carolina. And they were from Dayton, Ohio, and they selected the... There was a flat area north of Dayton that they built their first airstrip on. Well, World War One comes along in 1917 for the United States, and the military takes it over, and it's been a military establishment ever since. And two airstrips were created, and they've gone through so many name changes that it would give your audience a headache, as well as me a headache, in trying to go through all the different name changes. But ultimately, it wound up as Wright Field and Patterson Field, just north of Dayton. And it became the life's blood of the, I'll use the term Air Force, which went through a lot of name changes, became the life's blood of the Air Force in that it was the supply headquarters, it was the intelligence headquarters, it was the development of new aircraft headquarters, all of those things wrapped into one at the Wright-Patterson. Well, during World War II, it really expanded, and they started bringing in the enemy aircraft there to back-engineer them, to take them apart. This would be Messerschmitts and Mitsubishis and things like that, to see what made them tick and to see what we could build to that would be better to defeat them. So, and then the after the war, the Cold War starts, and our adversary is our former ally, the Soviet Union. And so they started bringing in MiG-15s and MiG-17s and what have you to find out what made them tick to back-engineer and better defeat them. So when this thing crashed at Roswell in July of 1947, what better place to take the wreckage than to Wright-Patterson? Because that they were already in that business of back-engineering, taking things apart, intelligence, and stuff like that. They also had an advanced aeromedical facility to take the alien life forms that were recovered at Roswell. So that's why everything went there. Started out as a, even as we speak, it's probably still our most important Air Force base in our inventory. So that's the history of it. But unlike Area 51, which actually was constructed in 1955 to build spy planes, Wright-Patterson has a history of dealing with alien technology and life forms that Area 51 only came late in the game to. Mm-hmm. And that's why we wrote the book, was to, as most people are familiar with the term Area 51, in terms of, oh boy, is that where we, that's where they have the aliens stored there, out there mm-hmm. in the desert. Well, we know for a fact that long before Area 51 was built, that was already going on, taking place at Wright-Patterson. So we wanted to bring that to the public's attention.
Now, in talking about the base, there was a Hangar 18. In 1980, there was a movie put out about Hangar 18. And there's just a lot of information that you have here. But in the fall of 2010, you got an email from a Mark Magruder, Marion Black Mack Magruder's son. And he had interacted with you previously because his father had had what was described as a close encounter at Wright-Patterson Air Force Base. And he went in and gave you so much information. I'm so intrigued with how people that have been in the military, that have had experiences are coming forth publicly. Many of them are older, and they're saying, well, what can somebody do to me? Kill me? What? That's a big deal. But I've got to let the public know. There is a big shift here that I'm seeing, and you can correct me if I'm wrong, that people that have a very strong sense of integrity, that have been very, very loyal to the powers that be, I'll use that statement, saying, I can no longer continue to hold the truth. Now, there are those that will go to the grave with whatever that truth might be, and it can be in various circumstances and conditions. But there are those that are standing tall and saying, no more.
Yes.
I have been violated. My trust, my oath, has been negated by lies, etc. So now I must speak my truth. And going to people like you that will say, please take this and publish it. Am I wrong?
No. What the Air Force did, we know for a fact that a lot of the military who were involved, or at least some of the military, the ones that we talked to who were involved in the recovery back in 1947, they couldn't figure out why this was being covered up. And the Air Force told them initially, well, it's a national security matter, but it's going to come out. We're going to go public with it. And they just kept saying that. Well, at some point, some of the people got fed up with this because they concluded, well, they're never going to go public with this, but they're lying to us about it, and we're not going to stand for it. I'm old now, and what can they do to me? So we've had a number of those come forward that just got fed up. They were near the end, and in our book, Witness to Roswell, we have a whole chapter on deathbed confessions, which essentially is what these are. And as far as Magruder kept the secret for years. He died in 1997, which was the 50th anniversary of the Roswell crash, but on the occasion of the moon landing, this would be 1969, the first moon landing, they were watching it on television, and one of his sons said, well, Dad, what do you think? Are there aliens out there? And he said, son, I know there are, because I've seen one that was alive, and that was the one he saw at Wright-Patterson in April of 1948. This was about a little less than a year after the Roswell crash. He actually saw the one that was recovered alive. So Magruder tells the story of how he got there. He was with the Air War College class, and they took them in to see the wreckage, and then they took them into another room to see this one that was still alive, and it just stunned all of them. And Magruder said that he told his son that he had great empathy for it, that somehow they made a mental connection. Without talking, there mm-hmm. was some sort of mental connection that it evoked great sympathy from Magruder towards this being that he was watching. Well, to cut to the chase, Magruder Sr. himself did not go public. It was his sons who later went public with the story. And it's not that they were, you know, looking for money or anything, because they weren't. I mean, their father was a retired colonel in the Marine Corps, won flight status, and after his military duty, his military career, he got in on the ground floor of the McDonald's empire, the hamburger empire, and he owned most of the McDonald's west of the Mississippi. So they were not in need of any monetary reward here, and it was just one of honor that the sons, he had five sons, Mark, Mike, Merritt, Marion Jr., and I can't remember the fifth son's name. They all began with the letter M. But they went forward because they did not want to keep this secret. They felt that they were duty bound to tell the information, and that's what they did.
You have a chapter called Reverse Engineering the Memory Metal. And I was fascinated with the details on this. And I was also fascinated to learn about a man by the name of John Paul Stapp. He was a physician, PhD, Air Force flight surgeon, who earned the rank of colonel and pioneered the study of rapid acceleration, deceleration on the human body. But this, there was so much information, or is, there is so much information on this chapter about this phenomenal metal. And there's a picture of a square piece of material, and how if heat was applied to it, let's say with a lighter, then every pore, I'll use that description, that's not probably the proper one, every cell of the metal would heat up equally. And you couldn't puncture it, and it was just an amazing material. And you have all of these people named in this chapter that became aware of this. And like I said, John Rocket Man Stapp, I didn't know anything about this guy because there's a lot of things I don't know about. But you have all of these people that were so significant in the development and understanding of certain properties. This was quite an accomplishment. Where have they gone with this? I mean, are we aware of any of this? We've got so much technology that's being utilized today, where the brain, the eyes, the brain coordination with items in helmets and so on and so forth that were sci-fi 15, 20 years ago. We're using it today. What happened with all of these great minds?
Well, Donna, this you're talking about re-engineering the some of the wreckage that was recovered from Roswell. Now, I've never been big on this back engineering stuff, you know, because there's been stories, Velcro, that you make things with Velcro clasps and things like that instead of zippers and buttons. Someone says, oh, well, that came from Roswell, that transistors came from Roswell, laser technology came from Roswell, and toothbrushes came. I mean, they get carried away, which sort of jaundiced my mind a bit, as that, you know, things might be traceable back to Roswell. Well, one of our associates, a fellow in Florida named Anthony Bregaglia, took another, he tried to determine whatever became of that memory metal, which is what you're talking about, the metal that you can wad up in your hand, fold it up in your hand, and let it go. It'll flatten right out without a crease or, any deformation at all, and you can't cut it, scratch it, burn it, do anything to it, just indestructible. And by the way, it's we call it the Holy Grail of Roswell, because that's what we're searching for most of all, is a piece of that memory metal. Well, Tony Bregaglia, in researching the memory metal, he was able to determine that it was primarily made of an alloy of titanium alloyed with another metal. He didn't know the other metal, but he started researching titanium, and he came across a series of journal articles in scientific journals by metallurgists researching titanium. But in the footnotes, he noted that a number of them cited a reference to a report from Battelle Memorial Institute in Columbus, Ohio, for Wright-Patterson Air Force Base. Wright-Patterson had asked Battelle to conduct studies of titanium-based alloys that would, in relation to shape-shifting or shape recovery. Well, that to me sounds like a memory metal. And that's what Battelle did, starting in 1948, right after the Roswell crash. The net result of it was the production of a product. You can go on the internet today and plug in nitinol, N-I-T-I-N-O-L, nitinol, N-I for nickel, T-I for titanium, and N-O-L for the Naval Ordnance Lab, who actually announced the discovery, or the resulting product, nitinol, in 1962. So Tony tried to get, there was a reference to a first progress report in 1948 and a second progress report in 1949, and he tried to get copies of those, and he sent FOIA requests to both Battelle and to Wright-Patterson. And while each of the historians at those facilities said, yes, we have those reports in our database, but we can't find them. We cannot find them, which means either they've been destroyed or they're still at a classification that we cannot get them. Mm-hmm. Well, to make a long story short, Tony finally did get them, not from Battelle or Wright-Patterson, but from the Defense Department had them, and they released them, highly redacted, of course, to Tony and a journalist he was working with in Florida named Billy Cox. And sure enough, there was enough in there that told Tony and Billy that this project resulted from the Roswell crash. And it goes along with a long story that someone had told earlier of having worked on this memory metal at Battelle Memorial Institute. So when you combine the two together, you get the inescapable conclusion that the military tried to reverse engineer this exotic memory metal. And the closest thing we have to it today is nitinol. You can go online, you can buy it by the sheet, you can buy it by the roll, you can buy it by the coil. It's used in many things, even the space program, and it has its roots, I am convinced, as is Tony, that its roots are traceable back to the Roswell crash.
For those of you that are just joining me today, we're talking with Thomas J. Carey. Inside the Real Area 51 is the title of the book, The Secret History of Wright-Patterson. Now, this book has a lot more than that in it. What they have done is an extensive amount of research, Thomas Carey and Donald R. Schmidt. They work together as a team, and it's not your typical UFO stuff. I get so weary of what I call the Hollywoodized versions that are just ridiculous. There are those ships. They are real. We have had so many people. I've encountered so many different people that have had the personal experience themselves, and these are not people from woo-woo land. So I know for a fact that there are other cultures, other situations that exist that have nothing to do with the planet Earth. And we're not the only ones in the galaxies. And I think all of the movies that have been done, Star Trek, The Next Generation, all of this has been very much in place so that the public can become aware that there are things that are going on. What is so disturbing to me is the fact that the people that are making the choices of decision about how the information is going to be disseminated thinks that the public, you and me, are too dumb to understand any of this. And of course, we're going to be nincompoops, and we're going to be terrified about knowing something. And I just go, what is the matter with these people? Perhaps all it is just a sense of wanting to have control and having power. I don't know. But I think we as human beings have a capacity for handling a lot more than what we're giving credit for. Now, Tom, would you be able to stay with me for about another 15 minutes? Because I'm
sure.
Going to talk about the Blue Room. I want to talk about Barry Goldwater. I want to talk about Pappy Henderson. You've got such terrific information in here. I really think that it's good to share. We're going to be taking a break. We're going to be back in just a moment. Donna Sebo here with Thomas Carey inside the Real Area 51. The Secret History of Wright-Patterson, and much, much more. All of this is really the real stuff. We're not talking about make-believe. We'll come back and talk about some more things in just a moment. Don't go away.
Donna Sebo publishes a popular, inspirational, and insightful newsletter filled with information about her upcoming guests, her travel schedule, seminar presentations, and upbeat articles to lighten up your life. You can subscribe to this free monthly newsletter by emailing her at donna@delphiinternational.com. That's donna@delphiinternational.com. You can also go to her website, www.delphiinternational.com, and review past publications. Keep in touch with Donna through this monthly publication. Again, her email address is donna@delphiinternational.com, and her website is www.delphiinternational.com.
Amino Muscle Snack Time, the chewable nutrition that feeds your muscles. Amino acids are the building blocks of protein. When you exercise, muscle tissue naturally breaks down. This low-cal, chewable snack helps to reverse that process and won't pack on the pounds. You can chew a few tasty vanilla tablets or any one of their other flavors before or after physical exercise, right before bedtime or first thing in the morning to jumpstart your metabolism into gear for the day. Convenient to carry in a purse, backpack, or briefcase, they are a tasty snack for the person on the go. Firm, fit muscles, trim, healthy body. Sound good to you? Check out Amino Muscle Snack Time Chewable Nutrition by going to Amazon.com or SquatSponge.com. Tone up, trim up, and nourish your body to the fitness level you desire. Amino Muscle Snack Time Nutritional Tablets. Check out the information and order today. Go to Amazon.com or SquatSponge.com. Order now.
Hi, this is Donna Sebo. Welcome back. We're talking about the real Area 51, the secret history of Wright-Patterson. I wanted to bring up Barry Goldwater and the Blue Room, Tom. That's Thomas Carey, one of the authors. He and Donald Schmidt have put together this historical information. Barry Goldwater had seen things. He knew things, and he found out about the Blue Room, and he was never, ever allowed in that Blue Room. And he said he did not know who controlled what was in it. He did not know who got to go into the Blue Room. It was classified top secret, and he was told he couldn't go in there.
That's correct, Donna. Barry Goldwater was a sitting U.S. senator from Arizona at the time. This, we're talking about 1963, he tried to get into the Blue Room. The Blue Room is usually the most secret place on any Air Force base, and at Wright-Patterson, the Blue Room, the most secret place on the base, was where they stored the aliens and the alien artifacts. And Goldwater had heard about it. He was also a reserve major general in the Air Force, so he had a dual capacity there. He was also the head of the U.S. Senate Armed Services Committee. So he was really a high-ranking official. And he was at Wright-Patterson in 1963 doing his tour of the base. And he was a UFO buff himself and had heard about the Roswell crash from his good friend, by that time, General William Blanchard, who was the commanding officer of the Roswell Air Base at the time of the crash. And so he's at Wright-Patterson. He says, well, I'm here. I may as well. This may be my only chance to get into that Blue Room to see these alien artifacts. So he called up his good friend, the chief of staff of the U.S. Air Force at the time, General Curtis LeMay. And he said, General, I'm at Wright-Patterson. There's a room here where it's common, rumored that all the alien artifacts and stuff are stored. May I go into that room to have a look for myself? And Goldwater told this story on television. I think he was on the Larry King show and perhaps one other show. And he said that he had never been cussed out like that in his life. He said that General LeMay started yelling at him. LeMay said, no, and hell no, you can't go in there. I can't go in there, which was a lie. I can't imagine Curtis LeMay, chief of staff, not having access to it. And he said, and if you ever ask me again, I'll see that you're court-martialed. Now, LeMay was a friend of his, and to talk like that to a sitting U.S. senator is Well, you know, it's hard to believe, but he did. And the effect was instantaneous on the Goldwater. He said, wow, he was taken aback. He'd never been cussed out like that. And he never brought up the subject again, much to our chagrin. But he said he never brought up the subject again. But he was no doubt talking about Building 18 at Wright-Patterson. That's where the stuff ultimately wound up. And he couldn't get in there himself. So he finally gave up and never tried again. And but he remained a UFO buff. He, you know, he got a lot of letters. And he was just the type of person that was respected on both sides of the aisle, which is unlike the way things mm-hmm. are today. But
yes,
he was well respected.
Well, I want to move towards another individual, Captain Oliver Pappy Henderson, because in 1947, and this is before he passed away, he said he had flown strange wreckage and little creatures from Roswell to Wright Field in early July of 1947. And the reason he did it is because he was at a point where he said, they can't do anything to me anymore. And he related the story of what he did to both his wife and his friends. When did that occur? What year was that?
Yes. Well, of course, the crash was in July of 1947.
Right.
And Oliver Pappy Henderson was a captain in the 1st Air Transport Unit. It's like the airlines of the Air Force. And they ferried mostly cargo and people. And he flew, we know for fact, because he ultimately came clean, that he flew wreckage and bodies from Roswell directly to Wright-Patterson on July the 8th, 1947. This was a few days after the crash. Well, he kept the secret until the, early 1980s. Never told his wife, never told his family, never told anybody. But one day, he and his wife were in the supermarket. This would be in the early 80s, say about 1981, 1982. And you know how in the supermarket they have these tabloids like Enquirer mm-hmm. and Star and Globe, those sorts of things as you check out. You know, they have wild stories that try to get you to pick them up on your way out. Well, he saw one there. This is 1981 or 82. It was about the Roswell incident. They had pictures of aliens or drawings of aliens, and it was the Jesse Marcel story that he had handled pieces of a flying saucer wreckage, et cetera, et cetera. So he says, "Oh my goodness!" Well, he turns to his wife. I forget her first name. But he turns to his wife and says, "Well." Oh, Sappho Henderson. He says, well, Sappho, I guess the story's out. I can tell you. I've been wanting to tell you for years, but now that the story's out, I can tell you. So when they got home, he told his wife that he was the pilot who flew those bodies from Roswell to Wright-Patterson. And he gave descriptions of them. He also had kept a piece of the wreckage for a number of years and told a dentist friend of his, who was a metallurgist, about that he showed him the piece of metallic wreckage, and the metallurgist dentist couldn't identify it. So ultimately, that piece, he sent it back, I guess, to the Air Force, and we never could find it. But he was one of the early witnesses who talked about bodies being found at the Roswell crash, and he kept it. He was dying of he died ultimately of throat cancer. He during a reunion, he told all of his former buddies in the Air Corps about it, and we interviewed all of those, and we said, you know, was he joking or was he telling the truth? He said, no, he was serious about this, and. You know, Pappy, they said, Pappy never lie. He wouldn't lie about something like that. And mm-hmm. so that's how we know that bodies were found and flown to Wright-Patterson is where they went.
My name is Jean Crane is the title of one of the chapters in your book. I'm 72 years old. I've outlived two husbands and survived cancer twice. What are they going to do, shoot me or put me in prison? And James Clarkson, who was a former police detective and security officer, got Jean's story. And in the beginning, she was very apprehensive because she had signed a non-disclosure agreement in 1952 when she left the employ of the U.S. Air Force. And the document threatened her with a fine and a prison sentence if she ever disclosed what she knew. Now, Jean was of a positioning. She was a clerk typist at the Foreign Technology Division at Wright-Patterson. She had very, very high security classification, and she saw so much of what went on. She actually saw what she talked about, and by golly, she said finally she wanted to have it, the information out there, because she was hearing all of these lies on television, and she had had it. She was a woman of tremendous integrity, as were so many of the individuals that have since passed on that you mention in this book. And I'm just amazed that James Clarkson was able to gain her confidence, because she was really afraid he was going to arrest her because of everything she had been indoctrinated about so many years before. Her story is just powerful. Give us a short synopsis of that.
Jean Crane had what they call a Q clearance. It's above top secret, and it cleared her for, she was a clerk typist, and it cleared her to type reports and things pursuant to the atomic bomb. That's what you need the Q clearance for, and she had that. It's the highest clearance on the base. And she was situated such that she was in the purview of top scientists and military people. So she heard a lot of what was going on. And what made her come clean, or what made her go public, she died in 1996, and she went public with James Clarkson, who was a police detective in Olympia, Washington, and Clarkson had interviewed many, many people. So he had a good sense of interviewing and reading people's body language and that sort of thing. And he could tell that she was not making this up, that she was basically trying to clear the decks, get it off her chest before she passed away. She knew she didn't have much longer, and this also would be construed as a deathbed confession. And she had herself had handled a piece of the memory memo from one of the officers who had come in from Roswell, threw it down on her desk, and he said, tell me what this is. And she couldn't figure it out. It was this memory memo. And she said, where did you get this? And the officer said, well, I got it from down in New Mexico. And that's all he would tell her. And just then another officer came into the room, and he quick grabbed the medal and put it in his pocket, suggesting that he was not supposed to have it. And so she was one of those cases where she had seen and heard a lot. She had to sign a non-disclosure when she left the Air Force, or left employment at Wright-Patterson. But near the end, and you know what put her over the edge, was the Air Force story about the Project Mogul balloon,
mm-hmm.
and the dummies from the sky.
Mm-hmm.
And so I take that back. She died in 1998, a year after the dummies story, where the Air Force said that the reports of alleged alien bodies at the Roswell crash site were really these dummies, these dime store mannequins that they had dressed up in flight suits in the 1950s and dropped from 100,000 feet to see their effect on the effect on these dummies from high altitude parachute drops. And she said that was enough for her. She had had it. That was absolutely not what happened. And she said, hell with the non-disclosure. What can they do to me? I'm 72 years old. All they can do is shoot me. And so that's when she finally went public by talking to James Clarkson. And it's one of those stories of many that we get, people happening to be in the right place at the right time, at least for, you know, for historical truth is concerned, to tell what they know. And I should point out that we have over 600 first and secondhand witnesses to the Roswell event, and not everyone, you know, they don't know the whole story. They only know their little piece of it. It's like it's like a big jigsaw puzzle, each one with a little piece to the puzzle. And it's Don Schmitz and my job to put all the pieces together to where they make sense. And that's what we do. That's what we've done in Witness to Roswell. That's what we've done in Inside the Real Area 51.
Thomas, we're out of time. I'm sorry to have to stop you. We're going to be taking a break. I want to thank you so much for spending the extra time with me. Inside the Real Area 51, the secret history of Wright-Patterson. Thomas Carey has been my guest. Donald Schmidt is the co-author. Together as a team, they've put together this amazingly documented batch of information. It's not just about little people in green suits. It's much more than that, and it's a very good read. We need to get past blindness and understand that sometimes there are those groups that have their agendas, and we need to be aware of that and just say, okay, what do we do? Thanks again for being my guest. This is Donna Sebo. We're taking a break. We'll be back in just a moment.
As a counselor, Donna Sebo is available for private consultations by appointment. These can be done by telephone or in person. If you'd like to schedule an appointment with Donna, call 253-582-5604 or 800-872-8852. That's 253-582-5604.
Good health is something all of us want to have. Being aware of what we eat, its nutritional value, and how to balance our physical needs with our busy schedules is always a challenge. Amino Muscle Snack Time goes a long way towards helping us meet this challenge. Amino Muscle Snack Time is a nutritional food product that is portable, tasty, and in chewable tablet form, vanilla and honey flavors, a bonus for maintaining a healthy amino acid balance for healthy muscles. Amino Muscle Snack Time can be used anytime, anywhere, first thing in the morning to kickstart your metabolism. Take 20 minutes before or after a workout to help recover and build muscle. Take mid-morning or mid-afternoon to help curb cravings for unhealthy snacks. Weight loss, appetite control. Only top-of-the-line and no genetically modified ingredients are used, no caffeine added. These chewable tablets can be ordered through Amazon.com or SquatSponge.com. Take charge and jumpstart your food program by adding Amino Muscle Snack Time by visiting Amazon.com or SquatSponge.com for more information. Order now.
Hi, this is Donna. Welcome back. Telephone number to call into is 888-627-6008. That's 888-627-6008. If you're a first-time listener, I invite you. You just call in, give me your first name or initial, and I'd be delighted to light up your life with a little bit of intuitive insight. And then, of course, when I'm finished with what I perceive, you're welcome to ask a question about anything that's significant to you. I wanted to let you know, those of you that are listening up in the beautiful state of Alaska, I'm going to be in Fairbanks and Anchorage next week. I'll be flying into Fairbanks doing some broadcasting up there, and I will be up there on the 15th through the 17th, and then in Anchorage from the 18th to the 21st. So if you'd like to meet with me privately, I'll be available. Give me a call at my office number, 253-582-5604, and I will set up a time with you. But also, for those of you that want to know the local numbers, go into my website, go to my newsletter, and you'll see the details listed in my newsletter for upcoming broadcasts and appearances. You'll find that that's going to be there. I wanted to share a quote with you And this is by Leo Tolstoy. And these are very powerful words. The most difficult subjects can be explained to the most slow-witted man if he has not formed any idea of them already. But the simplest thing cannot be made clear to the most intelligent man if he is firmly persuaded that he knows already without a shadow of a doubt what is laid before him. How many times have you encountered someone that when you become aware of something bigger than what, let's say, maybe your environment has taught you, you try to share it with someone else, and they stay in the confines of their little world and say, no, that's not possible. Not interested. Don't bother me. I already know the facts. How many times do we hear statements by people that are not even open to thinking outside of the box? Why is this the case? I think it's a part of the human being. I think that many times we are, and I'll use the term indoctrinated, that this is black and this is white. Now, I don't know why I came out of the box, so to speak, with a rainbow, but with my thinking. But I can remember days when I just said, oh, but you can't be correct. X, Y, Z said so and so and so and so. I can tell you, even today, I hear statements like that from people, intelligent people, people whose education and degree level is far superior to mine. And what I find many times is that it's scary to recognize that life is not necessarily black and white. It has a lot of colors in it. It has all kinds of shades, and the shades of gray are many. And I think one of the gifts that my show is able to bring to one's listening table is the fact that there are many different perspectives. You know, Thomas made a comment that I thought was a very astute one. He said, everyone, and they've interviewed well over 600 people, every one of these individuals have their piece of experience. Part of his job as a researcher is to take those pieces of experience and to be able to honor and respect that experience that they're going through, and then to be able to put it into the pot of information and make the bouillabaisse. Just like in cooking, you can have all kinds of flavors, tastes, and there is a multitude of ways, it's ad infinitum, that can be used. The same is about life experiences. And I think that when we're open and we're receptive, we don't need to be garbage dumps for people, but to learn how to think, to be able to process something, to be able to ask questions. This is so important. It took me a long time to learn to do that. It took me a long time to be unafraid of saying, you know, you might be right. However, I'm aware of this. What do you think of that? I'm aware of the other. What would you think of that? We get so afraid we want people's approval so frequently. It's good to question. And nobody in any position is going to know it all. And we need to be aware, one, because of the freedom we have in this country to be able to publish information, good, bad, indifferent, it doesn't make any difference. You as an individual have the right to choose what you want to read. You have a right to choose whatever area of expertise you want to become knowledgeable in. You have the right to choose, and that must be honored and respected. I've been in media for a lot of years, and it really concerns me today that I have so many people that say, you shouldn't be heard because you say such and such and so and so. Why not? It's very important that the freedoms, the right to be able to communicate are honored and respected. And it's very important for you to remember, anytime you give up your mind to either a substance or someone else saying, you tell me how to think, You tell me what to do. And boy, I'll go right along with it. That is a dangerous turf. Don't ever, ever give up the right to question, investigate, contradict, challenge. You don't need to step on anybody else in the process. But understand that how you live your life, how you think, how you feel makes a difference. Oh my goodness, we're out of time. Well, I'm so delighted that you've been able to be with me. Join me tomorrow because we're going to be talking about what every surviving spouse should know about veterans' benefits. Mary Markovich is going to be discussing this. What a gal. Oh, I just think she's given us a gift. I'll talk with you tomorrow. Remember always, you're the master of your fate. You are the captain of your soul. You belong to you and this wonderful universe and world that we live in. Enjoy the adventure. This is Donna Sebo. Talk to you tomorrow, same time, same place. Bye for now.
You've been listening to The Donna Sebo Show. We're delighted that you were able to join us and invite you to tell your friends and family about the program. Have a wonderful day.